I think it's obvious that I qualify to chair this meeting. I actually have more than a year of sobriety. I'm happy to say I have been around for a while, 18 years and a few days, one day at a time. And I started drinking at 13. Since I've gotten sober, I have had the blessing of remembering the desperation that I felt on my first meeting, and how shocked I was that I walked into a room of the most beautiful women. They all had their teeth. And I was so glad that in AA I have come to realize how wrong I have been about most things most of my life. And it helps me sometimes to remember when I have this tremendous need to be right that is not always the avenue to happiness. And I have attended a group conscience meeting, not recently, but I have attended them. And I know enough to stay out of the politics of organizations. I also want to remind you guys that, again, turn your cell phones off if any of you missed the earlier announcement, and, again, remain seated. Try not to move around too much out of respect for the speaker. I am so privileged to be here tonight because my little protege, also known as a sponsee in AA, who is on a mission trip in Africa right now, asked me to fill in for her tonight. And the speaker tonight is a man who is a dear friend of mine and has been for at least 18 of my 18 years, I think. And when I see him, I am reminded how vast and wide and deep and close the community of AA is in Orlando and outside Orlando. It doesn't matter where we go. We run into our like kind. We build bridges with our like kind. We can go to AA meetings almost anywhere in the world. And it has helped that world for me become very small and very dear and very loving and much safer than it used to be, certainly when I was drinking. So it is my privilege to introduce to you Mike S., who's going to share his story tonight.
Hi, everybody. I'm Mike Stevens. I'm an alcoholic. And glad and humbled to be here. I haven't spoken at Central in a couple of years, and as I was leaving tonight, the big boss, who was focused on a baseball game, most of you know the big boss, all 95 terrifying Sicilian pounds of her, she said, "Michael, will you please remember to get sober tonight and work a couple of steps?" So, Jen, if I'm not sober by about 20 till, will you can... Okay, I love Central Group. I've considered it my home group for practically since I discovered it. I'm a Southern Californian and came by Central Group in late 1990. I was about 3 and some months sober and had not worked in my practically lifelong chosen profession in sobriety. And suddenly things happened, and I was kind of beamed down here from L.A. on a project for Universal. And so I'd never been to Florida, and never been much less Central Florida. And I was living over, the company had me living out of the Twin Towers Hotel. My first impression was flat. I'm a Westerner. I've been around. I love mountains. I love the high country. I love the crags and waters of the high country, and spent much of my childhood traipsing around after my dad up in those wondrous places. And when I got to Florida, I thought, you know, if you come from the West, chances are you're like me, that your frame of reference is mountains. So you always know where you are because of X Mountain. And my first impression, and for quite a while, was how in God's name does anybody know where they are down? My great sponsor, Jeff O'Connell, had drummed into my head that as soon as I got down here and got settled in that hotel, to call the AA hotline down here and find out where some meetings were and get a road map and start getting hooked in with AA. And I had literally not been on an airplane in my first 3 and some years. That was just God's plan for me. As soon as I got out of the treatment center in early September 87, I thought I was ready to do films again immediately. And it, to my shock and horror, and then I settled into it, that wasn't the plan. He let me get good and sober before he parachuted me back into television. So Jeff hammered it into my head that I got connected with AA down here, and I'll never forget this deep southern gravelly voice drawl answered the hotline that day, and he says, told him my name, and he said, "Well, Mike, where are you from?" And I said, "Well, L.A., sir." And he said, "Well, I am too, Lower Alabama." And we have some friends around Central here these days that are Lower Alabamians, and they've been a lot of fun. It was a Sunday. And he told me that there was a central group meeting at 4 p.m. that day. And I don't think that meeting has existed in a long time. But I got the instructions on how to get from the front door of the Twin Towers to the front door of the old club next door at Central on a Sunday afternoon. And you know, I'd been around wacky California AA, which, you know, it's all the clapping. You clear your throat and they clap, and you know, they announce the grapevine subscription and they clap, and you know, it's all this clapping. And somebody gets a 30-day chip, they're invited to, you know, give a little gratitude spiel for God knows how long. And so I was always a little restless around that stuff. And I didn't know yet when I parachuted into the world-famous Central Orlando group and most other Florida AA, as it turns out, that they do things very different from there. And I loved it. I loved it. There was a lot less oratory, a lot less of what my old friend Aubrey Hayes used to call on and on meetings. Aubrey had about as much tolerance of participation meeting oratory as I do in my crotchety old age. And I remember one time he said, "Well, Mike, I may not have been to any bad AA meetings, but I sure as hell have been to some long ones." So I found my way here that afternoon, and what it did, among other things, was start getting me out in Orlando, because I didn't know anything about getting around down here if you didn't have any mountains to tell you where you were. So getting out to AA meetings here and in Winter Park and various places, but always centrally here, helped me negotiate, find my bearings here in Central Florida. I met some people at that little Sunday afternoon meeting who are still friends, are still sober and still friends, that stuck their hands out to this L.A. visitor, Jan Mason and Obie and Freddie from Maine, who's moved up north to the deep south now, but we're still in contact, and people who have remained friends were at that meeting and helped settle me in. So I love Central. I love Central. So, and I love the people of Central. And I love watching what happens to people that come in here all finished and stay all finished and get the vaccination and start smiling and then start hooking into things. And, you know, us old farts that have been here a while, the real cool thrill is to see what happens to you squirts that come in here and stick with it and watch the sparkle come back in your eyes and watch the smiles come back and watch you eventually get what we got, which is the ability to engage life fully, which is what I got. That's what I got. I got a, you know, I came from that indescribable aloneness that I think only late-stage alcoholics know, that utter aloneness, to this noisy, funny, sometimes maddening, sometimes heart-rending, often high-chair-pounding, out of impulse control, sometimes adult, wacky world that we inhabit around here. And what I got was the ability to engage a full life with the skinned up shins and the joy and the jokes and the love and the heart and the soul that's here and out there. And so I got a kind of a hypercolor sense around HD full life. And and most of you know my extraordinary little rascally ragamuffin wife Nina, who is simply about the most extraordinary human being I've ever known, and I've been gifted with extraordinary people all my life. I came from extraordinary people, and I'll say a few things about my highly functional non-alcoholic parents in a minute or two, but I've never met anybody quite like her, and you're just kind of wired with very special, kind of got the metabolism of a mosquito. And it's a, I just kind of, I often joke with Raymond, who's a member of her fan club, that I just get out of her way. And I call it a mixed marriage. It's this wasp white boy and that little Sicilian mosquito. And we're both independent cusses, and we fit well. We really fit well. We're very independent. Neither one of us are needy. And so we lead our lives independently and together. And we respect each other's territory and love each other and honor each other. And I don't know, that little girl has more strength of character than anybody I've ever met. So I'm a lucky, blessed man. I bring that little character up because most of you that are sitting in here tonight know her. You know, I hope to probably end this. It's a birthday meeting, and I want to keep an eye on the clock and end this by about 10 till. And I have already strayed off in a way that I kind of got tired of hearing my story done in the same way the last couple of times or so that I've been asked to share, so I'm going to kind of jump around, and which I already have, but Anybody here who knows me knows that I'm qualified to be here. But just to clarify things, I've been here since July 29th, 1987. Here was out there in on the left coast in the People's Republic of Los Angeles. And I've spent most of my adult life in the wacky world of mainline television, and I wasn't headed there. It was all just, it's funny. You know, here I am with a beard that looks the color of Santa Claus's, and I landed in the film industry at 26 with no plans to stay there. I had just beaten back the draft. I had just, a little before that, finished my master's, and before that, my bachelor's, both in history, and my plan, my love, even today and all these years, my love and avocation and passion is history. I like film, and I've had a lot of delights and a lot of great people and incredible adventures, particularly a lot of memorable stuff around the old filmmakers when I was young and coming up. I got to be around them at very close hand, and those pictures in my head are, you know, forever. They're going to have to throw dirt in on me before I forget them, and I treasure them. But I wasn't headed there. It was just all a kind of a fluke. I was headed for Germany and to restart my graduate work and go for my PhD in Nazi German studies, which was my specialty, and at the Institut für Zeitgeschichte in Munich. And I needed to put some money together, and an old college friend happened to be running the mailroom at Universal, and said, "Well, why don't you stay at your folks and come over here and work for me and have some fun and save every penny, and when you're ready to get to Germany, no hard feelings, and you'll have a ball." So I worked that out with him and with my parents, and that was the plan. And so much for my plans. We plan, God laughs. So I got interested in the place and started, just for the hell of it, going after things. And I had made some very powerful friends there who had a lot of muscle to get things moved and done for a squirt like me. And they picked up the phone, and suddenly I was moving upward, and never did get to Germany. And so history has remained my avocation, my passion, my love, all these years. I also would like to mention I'll be 22 years here the end of July, and in all that time, I suppose I've heard thousands of times people talk about being off to the races from the first drink, that they felt lonely or not a part of, and uncomfortable, and all of that, and when they took their first beaker often at a very young age, light bulbs went off, electricity happened, they plugged into the world and felt a part of it for the first time in their lives. And that was not the way it was for me. I have always been an extrovert and people person, and have always been plugged in with wonderful people, and came, as I briefly mentioned before, from a very highly functional, non-alcoholic, loving, consistent, highly on the strength of character side of things of my parents. I had a younger brother, Pat, who died of this disease when I was about a year sober, and I damn near did. So I got here with fully qualified on the nature problem, but I didn't come from a hellacious nurture place. I consider myself just very lucky that way, because most of the people that I've known throughout my stay in AA have not come from that place. Though I eventually run into them and we compare notes on our baffling functional childhoods. But I'm very thankful for the parents I had. They're both My mother was a Presbyterian, highly educated, wonderful, incredible woman who I was very close to. My dad was a mechanical engineer and tough guy and hunter and shooter and fisherman and an atheist. Not any blowhard atheist, not any breast-beating atheist. He left how the children were going to be reared spiritually up to mom. So we went to church with mother, and there was never any problem that way. There was never any tussle between them about their various beliefs. And it's funny, my father who died, he died like a samurai. And I honor him for it. In 1996, next month it'll be 13 years since Pop went to the lakes up there, and he wrote Nina and I a note a few months before he died. He had Parkinson's, and it finally at the end it got really bad, and he took care of things himself, which I always knew Dad would do. He was not cut out for rest homes and that sort of thing. I always knew, warrior that he was, he'd take care of it, and he did. But he wrote in his note to us about various financial details and things like that, but he said that I just love it. I just love it. He said, I believe when we die, that's it. But then he said, in that beautiful engineering printing of his, he said, but if I'm wrong, he said, I don't think the Great Spirit will hold it against me. And damn right, Pop. So I got off to a career and out in Hollyweird and crossed paths with an executive type, tall, bright, funny executive type female who I found amazingly challenging, and we hit it off She was a great gal, and we had a lot of good times and respect. But it was one of those deals where we were each married to the wrong person, and so I look at anything that got me here and got me to Nina, I look at as just fine with me. So whatever the plan was. That marriage lasted 5 years. We were both in the business. We both had careers going upwards. We had a young boy who was Carol's naturally, but I helped raise and has become quite a man. My drinking, which I had never done any in high school, had done some in college, but I went to a Lutheran university up in Washington, And it just never spoke to me from the first drink, like I have heard so many times from many others. Mine was absolutely gradual. The gene pool was out in my mother's end of the family. Three of her younger brothers, her three youngest brothers, were all alcoholics. My mother, her sister, and her oldest brother, none of them were alcoholics. My Aunt Lena and my Uncle Burke are both in their mid-90s now, and they were two of the three non-alcoholics in the family. So the others died far younger. When I got to college, I loved college and got in with some great scholars and tremendous history thinkers and writers and scholars and just knew that was for me. So I had great mentoring and all of that. Went on to graduate school, and then when the draft told me that they were going to throw some fun in there, then it got interrupted. But it was all in none of that early period was I drinking regularly alcoholic. My friends, when I finally got to AA, my college friends who have remained, we've all remained very close all over the West Coast, scattered very close all our lives since then. And they hadn't seen me in quite a while at the time, and they were all pretty much amazed that I'd ended up drinking myself nearly to death and had the problems that I did. So it was a long and gradual thing. But my drinking was kind of, I didn't drink for a long time. I drank a little for a long time. I drank more. I liked it more. It spoke to me more. I drank more. I gradually drank more and more, and eventually I was awash in it. It completely had me. It completely ruled my life. And that's pretty much my exciting how I got this thing. It has always kind of, my story about my drinking has always kind of bored me immensely. I broke out in handcuffs a couple of times, and the last day of the 10-day run I was on ended up being my last day out there. I wasn't a blackout drinker. I drank, I swam in oceans of alcohol those last two or three years. And even at that, was not a blackout drinker. I had gray outs and kind of oozy brown outs, but no full grade, utter lose huge blocks of time blackouts until that last day of that 10-day run. And when I heard friends telling me in early sobriety about their blackouts, some of them lasting months, I about dropped dead. I had nothing to go on but my experience, and it was all just news to me. So I remember a guy telling me in my home group, the Shakers early morning group back there, he was a guy, I just loved him. He came out of a blackout, his last blackout, sitting in the middle of his living room floor with credit card receipts and airline tickets and all this stuff from all over the globe, and sitting out there in the living room surrounding him, and he'd been on a blackout run for something like 2 months, and had been an active little fella during that time. So you know, stories like this always delighted me. I just didn't identify with them. I'll tell you one either advantage or disadvantage of not being a blackout drinker was when I sobered up, and it was in a treatment center, and that for me was what I needed desperately and what I got. I needed structure. I needed medical monitoring. I needed surrounding things. people and things, and I got what I needed. But I knew fast when I surrendered in there, and it was fast for me. I was through. I didn't know what you wackos had specifically, but I knew that you were staying successfully sober, and I knew I was just past my 43rd birthday, and I knew I couldn't stand another stinking, miserable day of that awful, foggy, grinding aloneness and despair that I was in and had been in for a while, where I felt isolated from humanity, where I lived in this beautiful place up on a hill overlooking LA. It looked all the way out to across the city to Catalina Island, and I would be up in the middle of the night sometimes looking out on that vast city with the distinct feeling that all those millions down there were leading their lives just fine, interacting, talking with each other, loving each other, and I was up on that hillside in that pretty place with that incredible view, dying, sliding off the edge of the world, and in an aloneness that I've never quite adequately been able to describe. So that's where it brought me. And so when I ended up that 10th day, I ended up that night in an incident that has never, one spark of it has never come back to me. I was in about an 8-hour blackout from about 11:30 that morning in good old Hollywood, coming up Highland Avenue. Bright day out there. I had just been supposed to show up for a producing job interview at Embassy Pictures that a friend had got for me. I was unemployed, unemployable, dying, and I had gone over for this. For this meeting, and when I couldn't find Embassy Pictures, a studio I've been to many times since then, not hard to find, when I couldn't find it on the first pass, I said, screw it, and headed back up with my traveling bottles on the seat next to me and headed back up Highland Avenue in Hollywood. And the lights went out, and they didn't come back on until about 8 that night in what I found out was the emergency room of St. Joseph's Hospital in Burbank on Buena Vista Avenue, right across the street from Disney Studio. I always loved that place in the book about the guy who found himself an employee of a company he'd once owned. In some of the time since that night of July 29, 1987, residing in the emergency room across from Disney Studio, I've had nice offices on the other side of the street at the Disney at the Disney Studio that looked right over at St. Joe's emergency room entrance, and it was a good, my God. Thank you. There it is, and there this is, a real life. So, two friends. One, a dear friend of mine, half Sicilian, half Irish, crazy artist, writer, producer, director, drinking buddy, alcoholic, and best friend, Nick Correa. I was supposed to be at his office that night. At Universal, and when I didn't show up, he got worried, and he called a girl named Charlene, a tough little Texan who I'd drunk away about 10 months before that, and he said, I'm worried about him. He was supposed to be here half an hour ago. I know something's happened. And would you start calling hospitals, and I'll start calling jails. If you find him first, call me. If I find him first, I'll call you. So Charlene took hospitals and Nick took jails, and the first place she called was St. Joe's Hospital, and they had me. And I was to find out later, she called another, an old childhood friend of mine, who'd gotten me into his head shrinker, whose care I was under for some deep depression at the time. Pour a quart of depressant down your throat every day, you tend to get clinically depressed. No, Dr. Strottmeyer was a very enlightened guy. He knew where I was, even if I didn't know he knew where I was. So she called the friend, and the friend called Dr. Strottmeyer, and he happened to be standing at the desk of this treatment center where he had some patient, and he made entry papers right there. She said, she loves to tell this story. She says in that little, she's about Jen's size, and she says in that little Texas drawl, "Doc, I think we finally got the son of a bitch where we want him. Now what do I do?" And so they conspired and made arrangements. Hey, he said, if you can get him out here, there's room, and they will take him and they'll help him. And they'll save his life. And I think you're right, he's ready. So she called Nick, and Nick got over the hospital and found me on a gurney watching my tootsies dangle. And not long after that, Tex arrived. And she looked at me and she said, "Michael, there's some folks waiting to help you. No. Now you'll come with me, won't you?" And I folded the shell. That was it. I have no explanation for that. That morning, it couldn't have happened in a million years. Couldn't have happened in a million years. Not a chance. You wackos were not on the radar screen. And that night, I was completely ready. I have been in that condition of readiness for nearly 22 years. I have been laughing and scratching and bleeding and crying and jumping up and down and having a full life with you, and that you is both coasts of you, since 1987. I always pay extra attention to 87 people. I suggest you all, whatever your years are, you do the same. I know a lot of you do. But 87 people really get me. And one's taken a birthday medal tonight, Heidi. And there's a few of us around here that are class 87 people. And we all kind of, we know. We know what that year was like. So that little treatment center in the San Fernando Valley, it was called Treatment Center of America. I was surrendered when Charlene said, "You'll come with me, won't you?" And I said yes. I didn't know it, but I was totally gone into the first step, and I was totally committed to this program. And in a matter of 24, 48, or 72 hours, I went through a complete psychic shift of being completely out there dying to being completely in here, surrendered, knowing I was in the right place, knowing I was committed to it, whatever it was, and that something really important was beginning. And I feel the same way now. So many of us have such a tough time at first. I was saved that. I've had a few tough periods back in my sobriety that took a lot of bleeding to get through. But knowing I was in the right place and knowing I was surrendered to this and knowing that I was willing to go where you kicked me was never anything I pounded the high chair over or dissected or did little sentence diagrams in the big book or did chemical analysis on or any of that stuff. I never fought it. I don't fight it now. I occasionally, as some of you know, fight alcoholics. But an old friend of mine, an old timer in AA, said to me years ago, Mike, you really do have an oversensitive gag reflex for bullshit, don't you? I think he was talking about intolerance and judgmentalism, but he was saying it in a way that I kind of like. But we can sometimes drive me crazy, as I'm sure I can do you. But you know something? It always comes back, no matter what kind of shitstorm I'm throwing, and they're not often anymore. But the fact of the matter is, AA can get along just dandy without Mike, and I can't live without you wackos, nor would I want to. I wouldn't trade you little rascals in for anything. And, it's about 10 till, so I'm not, I'm going to successfully, Claire, get through another pitch of not addressing the steps. I did them as directed. I highly recommend you do the same. I knew from the beginning who my ninth step amends needed to be, and I had a great sponsor who knew exactly where I was and that those needed to be done faster than anything. And so we did it that way. And The fourth step came a little later than my major ninth step stuff, but I did it under his direction and another old-timer's direction, and there were behooving reasons for it. So what it did was take my eyes off the floor at the studios and put them up at eye level to look those guys in the face. And they told me some stuff about me that I didn't know that meant a great deal to me and that really helped lighten my early sobriety. So I've had a lot of friends out there throughout my life. And a lot of you qualify. And I love you dearly. I love this group. I love Central. And I love you wackos. Thanks.